My guest, Peter Matheson, is a naturalist and novelist. He's written about his travels to Japan, the Himalayas, and Africa, and about Native Americans and American wildlife. Terence Dupré wrote about Matheson. His central thrust has been to celebrate the virtues of lost cultures, to praise the excellence of life apart from human life, to bear witness to creation vanishing. Matheson won the National Book Award for his 1978 book, The Snow Leopard, a journal which was part spiritual autobiography and part an account of his journey through the Himalayas. His other nonfiction books include Indian Country, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, Men's Lives, and Wildlife in America. His novels include Far Tortuga and At Play in the Fields of the Lord. He has a new collection of short stories that spans his writing career from the 1950s through the 80s. It's called On the River Styx. I asked Peter Matheson what kind of balance he likes to keep in his writing life between fiction and nonfiction.
Well, I prefer writing fiction, but there are things in nonfiction that I want to write about, whether it's a social action thing with American Indian problems or Cesar Chavez or a white shark expedition or simply an expedition to some remote part of the world. So I've done quite a lot of nonfiction, but I think of myself essentially as a fiction writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you started with fiction before you were writing nonfiction. Your first nonfiction book was the result of a series of pieces you wrote for the New Yorker magazine that started in 1956, in which you wrote about all the wildlife preserves in the United States.
Yeah, that one was not for the New Yorker. That Wildlife in America, that was called, and that came out in Sports Illustrated and various places.
Oh, I see.
And I didn't mean to write a book either. I was writing a series of articles on extinct and vanishing wildlife, and I discovered I was looking for the book that I finally had to write myself. It didn't exist, so it ended up, all that research, I put it together as that book.
How did you start gravitate to writing about nature?
Well, I've always been interested in nature. I lived in the country, and my brother and I were very interested in snakes. We both began kind of with snakes. We had a lot of snakes of all kinds, including copperheads. Which were quite common on this property where we lived in Connecticut. And then we had all other kinds, too. And he went on to become a marine biologist, and I was more interested in ornithology and was a sort of rabid bird watcher for years and years and took courses in ornithology and stuff.
Your naturalist writing precedes the ecology movement. It precedes Rachel Carson. Do you think that naturalist books have now reached a different audience or use a different language than at the time when you first started writing?
Yeah, really. When I started, it was back in 59, and there really wasn't very much available except sort of more specialized stuff. Now I think the whole environmental ecological parlance has come into the language, and people, for very good reason, are becoming more and more acutely aware of it. I think back in 59, something like this recent oil spill would have had very little attention. Now we realize we just can't afford this kind of disaster over and over.
Did you feel like you had to invent a literary style for yourself, or were there people who were writing about nature that you admired?
Well, there are many who were writing about nature that I admired, going all the way back several hundred years, and we've always had very good nature writers. Even people like Audubon was a pretty good writer as well as a painter, and so that tradition goes back a long ways.
Mm-hmm. In your early days as a writer, you were living in Paris, and you even co-founded the Paris Review. Now, Gay Talese, the writer has compared the apartment that you used to have in Paris, and I guess this was in the 1950s, he compared it to Gertrude Stein's salon and said that it was really the gathering place for American literati. And I get the feeling that your interest in social circles has really changed, that you're less interested now in opening up your apartment or in having that kind of social circle.
Well, it really wasn't a social circle, although a lot of those young writers were friends. We had a kind of and it was the base for the Paris Review, and a lot of writers came there. And Bill Styron used it actually as the locale in one of his, I think, set this house on fire, and so it became a kind of a celebrated place. It wasn't that big a place. I was paying $19 a month for it, but it did have big windows, and it was up in a sort of poor area of Montparnasse, and so it was kind of a great spot. But it isn't. I don't think I've changed my. I'm more interested now in kind of activist things, in the environment, and working on an American Indian case and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Peter Matheson is my guest, and he's a naturalist and novelist. His new book is a collection of short stories that span his whole writing career. The new collection is called On the River Styx. One of your books was about Zen Buddhism and about practicing Buddhism, and at the beginning of the book you explained that it's not something you were really anxious to write. You basically did it at the urging of the head of a Zen center in New York. What are the things that trouble you about initiating conversation about Buddhism or perhaps about any other approach like that or religion?
Well, it's I think almost in the nature of Zen, to speak about it is already kind of missing the point, because Zen, the whole teaching depends on the immediacy and the spontaneity of this present moment. And the minute you talk about it, you're introducing ideas and concepts that get in the way of seeing directly, which is the whole basis of the training. And to see everything directly and then see behind it another way of looking at reality, which will happen through meditation practice, and really enhances one's life. So there's a built-in contradiction in writing about it. On the other hand, even the meditation is a tool, and the writing is a tool, and it helps people, prepares the ground for this sort of insight and training.
You once said that it's hard to talk about Zen without succumbing to that mystery-ridden prose.
Yeah.
What kind of language are you talking about?
Well, the thing is, you see, we're in Zen, and it does deal in terms of mystical states sometimes, and those mystical states are almost, there's no vocabulary for them. So we have to fall back on strange either Sanskrit terms like samadhi and satori and words like that, or rather addled sort of fuzzy terms, even enlightenment itself, and that's properly understood as a rather fuzzy term. We speak of emptiness, we speak of all sorts of things which really have, in fact, there's no vocabulary for. And I think we have been, as a culture, we've been very timid about anything we didn't have a specified, nailed down vocabulary for. You know, a lot of things that were so-called supernatural are simply because we have no scientific parlance for them, no way of appraising them in a logical, so-called way.
Did you seek out Buddhism, or did you happen into it?
No, I didn't. I didn't seek it out, nor did I happen into it. I was during the '60s, very early on. My then wife, who's since died, we were very interested in finding a teacher of some kind, and we couldn't. There weren't really any around in the early '60s. And we got into experiments with LSD, and we did a lot of LSD during the '60s, not as a recreation, but as a way of seeing something else, seeing things another way. And that kind of wore out for her pretty early. I went on with it a bit longer. And she went over to a Japanese tea ceremony, and then from there, through friends, to a Zen teacher who's then working in New York City. And I, a year or two later, did the same thing and found that it was far more effective and far closer to what we originally had in mind than the drug use was.
Had you ever asked any of your teachers what they thought about taking LSD?
I think they feel that any chemical is a screen that gets in the way, and I think that's true. I think these drugs, if properly used, and if you knew what you were getting, which you don't anymore, in the old days of LSD it was quite different, because Sandoz Chemicals in Switzerland was making it, and you knew exactly what the dose was, and they knew exactly what the amount was, and there were very useful ways of applying LSD. But a Zen teacher, or any spiritual teacher, would be against it simply because you're not seeing things purely. There always is that, finally, that chemical screen, even if you are having an extraordinary vision of existence.
One of the founders of the school of Buddhism that you practice, Soto, had said that the way to be truly universal is to be particular, moment by moment, detail by detail. And I wonder if you see that as really applying to writing as well, that to be universal you really have to focus on detail?
I think so. I think all really good writing is attention to detail. It's that one detail, that one scrap of dialogue, that one color or smell that brings the whole scene to life. You can't throw in everything. You'd be just writing all day long over one small scene. So you have to find that one thing that the reader can build up from. For example, William Faulkner, he was extraordinarily skillful. He would pick out one or at most two physical characteristics of somebody and then just repeat them over and over again, and the reader gradually builds up a whole character around that one physical detail, because the detail is so well chosen that it serves you in this way, you can do it.
There's an injunction of Zen that you've written about that says, seek nothing. You might want to explain what exactly that means, but I wonder how that applies to another part of your writing, which is journalism. For instance, in your book, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, you did a lot of investigative work into what happened around the time of Wounded Knee. And, you know, the seek nothing injunction, I don't know if there's a way of interpreting that where it would apply or if you see that as being really contradictory.
No, I don't see any in contradiction there. Seek nothing, it means really to go in to life and to observe it moment after moment with no gaining idea. I mean, that life is extraordinarily diverse and rich and precise and open and beautiful and also terrible. If properly observed this way, just observe without ideas of good and bad. So in that sense, there's no attachment, no clinging is a very important sort of underlying thesis of this practice. I don't think there's a contradiction there. At the same time, one is in real life, one is faced with social injustice or environmental pollution or the various other ills of our time. And it's true that certain Buddhist people would say that you should not enter into social action as the blind leading the blind, unless you're an enlightened person. How dare you presume to guide or other people? But sometimes you just can't spend your life on a black cushion, and there is great need or suffering outside your door, and you kind of have to deal with it. That's who you are in that moment, and that's an expression of yourself in the Zen way. So I find there's no contradiction, and I think most American Zen leaders and teachers feel that way. There's more and more of a trend toward activism, toward how we work in our group with the homeless and low-income housing projects and job training and that kind of things.
I want to ask you something else about Zen, and this is from something that you said in your Zen Journals book, Nine-Headed Dragon River. You were explaining that you were studying to be a Zen monk, studying in the States, and you had passed 13 of 14 checkpoints. You failed the last, which was about the vital expression of the inexpressible. And you said you were only able to come up with a weak intellectual answer. I found that a fascinating thing to stumble on for a writer. And I was wondering if you'd tell us a little bit about what this means.
That's in koan training, which is part of formal training for the priesthood and so forth in Soto Zen, and also in Rinzai Zen, and any kind of Zen. And that's a very famous koan, that the sound of one hand. Usually it's called the sound of one hand clapping, but it's actually the sound of one hand. What is the sound of one hand? This is a koan that stops you dead like an iron wall. I mean, where can you go with that? Logically, it just makes your whole logical apparatus collapse. And that's the point of it, that you see it all from a different way. And nonetheless, you could arrive at a kind of an answer which would be adequate, without quite understanding the subtleties and what's behind it. So there are 14 checkpoints of that koan, and you have to pass all 14 of them, and they're kind of increasing in difficulty and subtlety and so forth. So finally, an intellectual answer is not nearly good enough. You have to manifest that koan or present it, and this is part of the training.
Well, let me ask you again how that connects with your writing. Has that training and not using the intellectual to explain or to understand helped you in your writing?
I wrote a novel called Far Tortuga, which is my own favorite of my books. And one reason it is because I tried to replace simile and metaphor and image with just these very simple descriptions of the thing itself, for example, the feelers of a cockroach coming out from underneath a galley cabin on a ship deck, or the water vibrating in the rim of an oil drum on the deck because of the diesel motor. Just these things, just to see, or the line of birds migrating along the horizon, just if the reader could see those and see the immense mystery and hugeness of existence so shimmering behind those very, very concrete details. And I think that there's no question in my mind that Zen training and was a strong influence on that book, even though the book ostensibly has nothing to do with Zen.
You've also written a lot about Native Americans, and I was wondering how you started writing about them.
Well, I think from my earliest readings from James Fenimore Cooper very early as a small boy, I became interested in American Indian people, and there's an American Indian victim even in my very first novel called Race Rock, and there's quite a lot of Indian material in wildlife in America, and in fact it goes all through my work, South American books and so forth. So I've always been aware of this situation and uncomfortable about it. But it wasn't really till the mid-70s that I was doing some spiritual research with traditional Indian people out west, and I spent a lot of time on rather remote reservations. And when I was there, these people would answer my questions, and then they would say, well, we have a very unfortunate situation here, and the government is doing this, and this is what's happening here, the ranches or whatever. Can you give us some help or some publicity and try and get attention to us? And so I agreed to do that, and I started writing these articles for various magazines. And in the course of that, I heard about this case of a man named Leonard Peltier, who had been, according to the Indian people, unfairly prosecuted and jailed for life for allegedly killing two FBI agents. And it's a very, very striking and tragic case. And I was sort of drawn into that. I wanted to get a young Indian writer to do it, but it was rather more urgent than that, and they thought I had enough of a name so it might help get attention. And so I was drawn into that case. So I did two books. One was called Indian Country, and that's a whole series of Indian situations all around 48 states. And the second one was called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, which is specifically the story of the American Indian movement and this man, Leonard Peltier, who is presently in Leavenworth, and we're still trying to get a new trial for him. And it's been all sorts of hearings, and we're trying to get film interest. And in fact, there is a film, I think, there's a very strong possibility a good film will be made now.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, was the subject of two lawsuits, I believe,
mm-hmm.
By people who you'd written about in the book who said that you'd treated them unfairly and misrepresented them. You won the suit, but there was a while when this book was not on the shelves. Did this make you more of an activist in the writing world?
Well, first of all, I should comment on that. First of all, we have not won the suit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had.
There were two suits, and they totaled for $49 million. One of them, brought by an FBI agent with the apparent support of the FBI, was thrown out with a summary dismissal by a court in Minnesota last year, and they're appealing, but nonetheless, the case has been dismissed. The second case was brought by Governor Janklow of South Dakota, and that was also thrown out on the lower court level. It was reinstated by the state Supreme Court in South Dakota, so it's still pending, and it's possible we'll still have to go to court. This is 6 years later. The book is not available until these cases are settled. The Viking Press does not want to ask for, you know, to sort of inflame the situation any. And there's no paperback copies, and there's no European editions. They all backed off because of the threat of suit. Viking has, and their insurance company, have spent over $1 million trying to defend this already, even though every court judgment has been in our favor, and no lawyer except for the lawyers or the plaintiffs seems to think there's any basis for libel here. But nonetheless, the book has been entirely suppressed, and Viking and the insurance company have been penalized, but have lost a lot of money. So I think no other publisher right now would take on a project like this. The freedom of speech, the First Amendment rights have been severely damaged already by this case. Even if we so-called won tomorrow, the freedom of speech has been hurt very badly.
Mm-hmm. You know, in addition to writing about political social issues surrounding American Indians, you've also written about Indian art and spiritual values. And I was wondering if your interest in Indian art affected your own views of your own art and what you wanted from it.
Well, I find that the Indian writing, the oral tradition, and the Indian art and painting and sculpture is just extraordinarily strong and pure. And it ties in very well with my Zen training. In fact, I remember when I was traveling with Indian people, they'd say, well, what do your Zen teachers feel about you listening to our spiritual people and so forth? And there really is no conflict. Zen considers itself the religion before religion, and anybody from any religion can practice it. It's simply a way of, an underlying way of seeing the world, and the world view is so in tune with the American Indian spiritual view, or in fact of almost all traditional people. It's a very ancient teaching that came before the religions. So these things all work together. I don't think I've answered your question. I lost track of...
Well, I remember in one of your books you said that in, or perhaps this was in an article, that in Indian culture art wasn't measured in terms of just beauty or sensibility, but in the power that it had.
That's true, and also in the religious power, the spiritual power it had, which is why until very recently Indian artists didn't sign their work, you know. And I think Georgia O'Keeffe actually was criticized at one point, or at least somebody said, "Why don't you sign these works?" And she said, "I might as well sign my face," which is a wonderful answer, and that would be a wonderful American Indian answer too. They feel it's an expression of the great mystery coming out through the vehicle of this person. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing to do with ego and fame and money, that you shouldn't be attaching all that to it.
Your book, The Snow Leopard, which won the National Book Award, was based on your travels through Tibet and through the Crystal Mountains in 1973. Do you think of yourself as an adventurer at all?
No, I really don't. I've been described that way, and it's true that if you pursue the interests that I do, you're going to have adventures whether you like it or not. As somebody says, adventures usually come about because of bad planning. And I've had a great many so-called adventures, but adventurer in the sense of seeking out adventure, certainly not. I'm not in any way a Hemingway-esque person who loves adventure in that sense. I don't like being scared. And I've been scared plenty often, and I know what it feels like, and I dislike it very much indeed. But sometimes you have to undergo certain risks to accomplish what you're after.
Well, if what you were seeking wasn't adventure, tell us what you were seeking when you went to Tibet.
Well, I went with a friend of mine I'd worked with in Africa, who's a wonderful field biologist, probably the best around today, George Schaller, who's written many books and, in fact, has won the National Book Award, too. And he was studying the Blue Mountain sheep, so-called. He was convinced this so-called sheep of Asia was a goat relative, probably a primordial creature, that a sort of ancestor of both goats and sheep. And he was interested in proving this, and we discovered that at the Crystal Mountain, because of the Buddhist Lama there, and there was no killing of animals allowed, and that everything was very tame, even the wolves, and possibly snow leopards, and let alone the sheep. So we trekked to get to this extraordinary kingdom up on the Tibetan plateau. It's not quite in Tibet, it's in northern Nepal, but we had to walk about 250 miles across the Himalaya to get there. And I was hoping the Lama of the Crystal Monastery was there, and indeed he was. So for me, it was a Zen Tibet, a Buddhist pilgrimage, as well as a natural history one, and an extraordinary, for me, experience.
You've written about many faraway places, Africa, Japan, but one of your recent books was very close to home. It was called Men's Lives, and it was about fishermen who live near where you do.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you back to home for a subject?
Well, I still live in that general region, and I became a commercial fisherman originally because I was a young writer writing fiction, and the books were getting good reviews, but they weren't making any money. I've never been a bestseller list writer, really. And so I had to do something else. I was married, and I had a couple of kids and so forth. I was just having them then. And so I went into commercial fishing in the fall and the spring. I would go clamming and stuff in the fall, and I'd go haul seining with these dory crews in the ocean off the ocean beaches of Long Island in the springtime. And then I ran a deep sea charter boat in the summertime taking people out fishing. So that's really how I got into it. And I got to know these families and these men and really admired them a lot and enjoyed their company. And only a few years ago, when the striped bass was being eliminated as a commercial fish on our coast here for various reasons, a lot of them political and, to my mind, unjust, the sportsmen kind of ran the commercial guys out of business because the striped bass was the difference between mere subsistence and a decent living. It was it's a very prized fish and so forth. So I felt the time was ripe, and so other people out there did too, and a lot of photographers were interested, and we put this book together. A woman named Adelaide de Menil was the one who sponsored it and funded it and was very generously behind the entire thing, photographs and the text. And that's really how that happened. It was an effort, a last-ditch effort, to try to get attention and help to these guys.
And what were the results?
The results were that we were a little bit little bit late. They were kind of legislated right out of business as far as the bass goes, and the commercial fisheries now in the end of Long Island are, which have been going since the earliest days. These are our pioneer fishermen. These are people who came from England, settled there. There's a few of them still out there, never have gotten as far as New York. They still speak in this extraordinary dialect, this so-called Bonnic dialect. They have an enormously strong tradition there, and they would rather fish than make money, but now they're just forced right out of it due to this this legislation. And I think it's a great pity when a traditional group like that is obliterated.
Mm-hmm. Now, your new book is a collection of short stories called On the River Styx, and it includes stories from the 1980s and includes stories dating back to the 1950s when you started writing. Did you reread all these stories before they were published? And if so, what was the experience like for you of going back and reading some of your earliest work?
Well, I was a little embarrassed. In fact, I mentioned in the preface that years ago, Random House asked me to do a collection of stories, and I could only find seven that I would attach my name to, and I'd written about 25 or 30. But now they all seem to be such greenhorn stories and kind of callow, you know. I didn't really want them out with my name on them. So I said, there's not going to be any collection. But then since then, I wrote two more long stories, and I rewrote one of the ones that I was thinking of before, making 10 in all. And so there they are, and there is a big range. But the very first story that's in the book, and the earliest story, won the Atlantic Prize, and that was when I was in college. And two or three of the others are prize winners. And so I guess they're okay. I'm, you know, old stuff, you know, you're always a little bit uneasy with it, but other people seem to think they're okay.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing. Thank you.
Thanks very much.